The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Today, the general manager at Essex Golf and Country Club. This is a man who's worked at tons of restaurants and some really good golf clubs as well. It is Corey Latasseur. Corey, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Matt, pleasure to be here. Long time coming, and I'm looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, well, I mean, I first met you, I feel like it was years ago, at St. George's Golf Club. I think it was there.
And yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, and I remember I was looking at the wine menu, because that's what I do. It's what we all do. And yeah. I noticed you had a couple bottles of Sauvignon on your list. And my first thought was, ooh, sneaky Somm trying to put on wines they love to see if they can get any bites.
Yeah, so guilty as charged.
Did anyone get that wine?
No. You know, it's one of those wines, amongst many of those wines that we're probably going to reference over our chat. You know, you want to build a list and obviously find balance and you make sure that you cover all the angles. And, you know, you can never cover all the angles because there's just too many now. But, you know, those are the wines that you would put together for, you know, a five-course tasting menu. Those are wines that you would sort of do on a one-off for an education, right? So, you know, Sauvignon is wonderful and unique and exquisite as a wine like that can be. It's hard to sell those wines to people, even with a little bit of romance and history, and, you know, because they're not super cheap at the same time, right? Even in clubs with, you know, are very favorable markups, sometimes people defer to their comfort zone.
Yeah. Okay. So I got a couple follow-ups. And for people who don't know Sauvignon, 100% Chenin Blanc from a small little Appalachian Loire. Actually, Corey, real quick, if you could go full LinkedIn for the listeners, just about some of the main places that you've worked at over the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I grew up in the industry and got cut my teeth at Overtures and Eatery, which is in the Windsor area where I'm originally from. And that's really where I got the wine bug. And, you know, hats off to Chef Glenn and his former wife, Vanetta, for giving me that opportunity to explore wine and learn about it. And then spent the better part of 12 years at a restaurant called El Gabbiano. And sort of that's where I took my wine sort of knowledge and interest to the next level, got my certification through the ISG, and then moved to Toronto to pursue the opportunity to run the wine program and the F&B program at Granite Club, and spent the better part of 5 years there and really got immersed in sort of a wonderful operation, wonderful opportunity, lots of learning, lots of growing, working with a seller that was already well established. So I think I got spoiled and had the opportunity to sort of learn what a great program can be. And I think that's the sort of mantra that I've taken with me ever since. I moved on to the Spoke Club after that in downtown Toronto. I ran the wine program, F&B program there, then up to Hockley Valley, up in Orangeville, director of restaurants in Somme, and then found my last home, which was St. George's Golf and Country Club. It's better part of 6 years there and really sort of revamped the wine program and took off. Partnered at a Harry's Steakhouse in Etobicoke and then decided to move on and happily came back to Windsor to take on this GM/Somm role, shall we say.
Yeah. Okay, good. Just for the audience, just to get your breadth of experience. Now let's go back to the Sauvignon. I don't know why I find this interesting, but I treat it like almost like you're fishing. And you got the bait, and the bait is this beautiful 100% Chenin Blanc. And every night that you're working, you're putting out there, you're trolling, you're hoping you'll get a bite. And then did you ever get close? Did somebody ever get close and then decide just to I'll have the Mondavi Chardonnay instead?
Yeah, it's like when you put it's a good analogy, you put the line in the water and you got the bait on the end of the hook and you pull the line up and all the bait's gone, but the hook's still there, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, I think there's been that time when after you've built enough trust with a certain customer and or member, that you can have that opportunity to say, you know what, I know you've been drinking Sauvignon Blanc for 10 years or 15 years or whatever it might be. There's enough trust there for me to open it. And my sort of, I don't want to say tagline, because that's not a word I want to use, but I'm always willing to say, hey, if it's not your jam and you're not digging it, I'm happy to take it back and, you know, sell it off by the glass or use it for staff training or something along those lines. And I would say 9 times out of 10, you know, you put the ball back in their court and it becomes a wonderful thing, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I saw it there and I could see it is. It's a tough sell because it's not very common wine. And by the way, I got no problem at all. People, they go out for dinner, especially their golf club. They know what they like and they just want their comfort food, which is great. Like, I'm all for it. But, you know, it's, for everyone listening, get out there and try it. it's not your Tuesday wine, but yeah. you're going to love it. Okay, yeah. Corey. You don't have to give an answer to this question.
Okay.
I'd say that on the front end. I'm like, where my cottage is, I'm up in Muskoka, and right. There's a place called the Bemoris Yacht Club. And what always amazes me is this place is filled with some people with good amount of money. And whenever there was a party there, everyone would bring their own wine. And because I'm really nosy, I would look at every bottle of wine that was brought.
Sure you would.
Of course. I'm so nosy. And what would shock me, I would usually bring the most expensive bottle of wine. And this is for everyone's own personal consumption. It's not like some sort of potluck.
Yep.
But what amazed me is like, I'm like, wait a minute. You're all much richer than I am. Why do all of you have a $16 bottle of wine? Like, have you ever been shocked in all your years? Because you've worked at places where there was people with money. Good for them for having money. The work they did to accrue whatever wealth they have. Yeah. Did it ever shock you when they were just content with like the $9 house glass of white wine?
Yeah, more than you would probably believe, and I won't reference names or places, but it is quite shocking sometimes. I mean, obviously, you know, people have their favorites and will continue to do so regardless of whatever spiel you want to give them. But sometimes it's funny when someone brings in a bottle of wine and the corkage is more than the actual cost of the wine, and you sort of shake your head and say, you know, we're willing to do whatever it takes to make you happy, but, you know, there's great opportunities off our list that will probably give you more of a bang for your buck, and that's the reality of it. But it happens quite often.
Yeah. Oh, and they have got like 9,000 square foot homes, and they're, my favorite story with that was about at Canoe when someone brought a magnum of Yellowtail to Canoe.
Of course, yes. Why wouldn't you?
People can't see this on the podcast. I'm rolling my eyes in just complete disgust. So before we started, we're asking what you were asking what I was drinking. And it's just a California Shard. And I always say my guilty pleasure is slightly overly oak Chardonnay. I will drink it and I recognize whoever made this wine, they've added stuff to it to hide the wine. They've added a little extra oak and all that stuff. And I recognize it, but that is my guilty pleasure, just like meatloaf, bat out of hell, is my guilty pleasure music. Do you have a guilty pleasure wine that maybe you don't want to admit when you're with the wine cool kids?
My standard go-to, and I don't know if it's a guilty pleasure, but something that never seems to disappoint, is Sangiovese. You know, it could be the $9 bottle of Chianti, you know, no Classico, no just straight up Fiasco bottle, whatever you want to call it. That seems to be my guilty pleasure only because I know it's going to satisfy whatever need might be there on the table or just on its own. So I would say Sangiovese would be sort of my reflex, shall we say.
By the way, just a tip to listeners, I've said it before, there's two areas for me that I find always deliver great value. One is, you can find really, I think you can find good Cote de Rhones for $13 to $15.
100%.
And the same thing with Sangiovese. You can even get DOCG Classicos for like $16.95, but you can get plenty for $11-$12 just DOC level. That all you really want is, does it taste like the grape? And that's usually right. It does.
Yeah. I think you brought up a good point, Matt, with the Cote de Rhone. Like, for me, that's a great segue region for people that are New World focused, like, you know, their Merlots and the Cabs and the Shiraz and all that kind of stuff. It's that great segue wine that doesn't offend anybody, because there's nothing to offend you when you have a nice bottle of Cote de Rhone, and it's probably going to be under $50 on most lists, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. Is that like, I don't know how often you would try to do it, probably more. And I guess for you, Corey, and we'll discuss the difference between working in restaurants versus working at Essex or St. George's or a place like that. When you work at private clubs, you get to know the members. So as you mentioned earlier, there's a trust. How many times, and not out of any ego thing, but just out of a, hey, let's get you to try more stuff. How many times would you use a Cote Daron to try to get the Napa cab drinker over into the old world?
Three or four out of 10. Okay. You know, if the Napa cab drinker is in the 150 to 175 range, you know, it might not be Cote Daron. It might be Chateau Neuf or Cougie Condas or something that I can get a couple more bucks out of. Right.
So yeah, of course.
You're carrying that same style, but it might have a little bit more structure, a little bit more personality. So,
yeah. And also needs to be said, and I feel I'm guilty of this all the time, where I just shit on Napa cab. Tom Eddy, brilliant.
Oh, so good, eh?
Oh, and by the way, his second label, I've got like 10, 11 bottles of it, like, you know, and like 2015. So like, yeah. But not just Tom Eddy, Dariush makes great stuff. There is a lot of good Napa cab. I know
it's lots of good Napa cabs.
It's one thing I'm going to say we in the wine community, sometimes there's an eye roll about, oh, another bottle of Silver Oak, but even Silver Oak, and there's a lot of good vintages, but I just, you know, there's Napa cab is great. I think the problem sometimes in the wine industry we have is when people only go for Napa cab, it's not a snobby thing. It's we want to show you 100 other wonderful things that are also wonderful to drink.
100%. And that I find is probably the largest category, especially in private clubs, is Napa cabs, because it's a comfort / recognizable bottle on the table.
Yeah.
You know, I find those grape varieties that everyone can pronounce are always ordered a lot. You know, their friend is drinking this, so I'm going to drink this type thing. It's that, again, that sort of a comfort thing. And, you know, I have to agree with you wholeheartedly that there's a lot of great Napa cab. Generally, everyone drinks them way too young. So when you start to see them with 5, 6, 7, 10 years on them, man, they become magnificent. And they start to lose that sort of showy, in-your-face style, and they become quasi-elegant and, you know, take on a character that is just unreal. We just never let them get to that stage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Amulet, Dana Estates. Hell, even just Robert Mondavi.
Absolutely.
Like Mondavi, these are great Cabernet. So I wanted to give a quick PSA because they often get on the negative side. How hard is it for you to sell Canadian wine, especially to men?
It's easier than it used to be. The part two of that answer is it's still hard. You know what I mean? Like, it's the number one seller, you know, in the LCBO, but it's not the number one seller in any list I've ever created or worked. I'm a huge advocate of Canadian wines. I've always been a supporter. I've always been a staunch, like, you know, we got to drink more. And thankfully, the quality level has increased exponentially over the last, you know, number of years. Used to judge y'all Canadian wine championships, and it's amazing to see the quality of wines that are being produced in our country that people don't even get to really have access to, you know, some cool stuff out of BC and sort of the niche, you know, Nova Scotia stuff in Quebec and of course in our own backyard. And I think a lot of the stuff that is on the LCBO shelves, even though it is getting better, isn't the super awesome stuff that is really being produced by some of these producers. So getting back to your question, is it a hard sell? Yeah, it is a hard sell. And if you have trust in moving someone from a Napa cab to a Cote Daron, you better have a lot of trust moving someone into a Cab Franc from Ontario in a quasi okay vintage, right?
Yeah.
So again, it's making sure you pick and choose your battles, and it's good to wave the flag, but you don't have to wave it at every opportunity, right?
Yeah, I like Two Sisters, Merlot, Cassava.
Oh man, beauties!
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
there's so many little gems out there that I think people haven't had the opportunity to be exposed to. And sometimes when you know, I don't want to say try and fool them with a blind taste, but a lot of times people are like, wow, where's this from? No, can't be. And it's those are the great experiences because they're out there.
You got to fool them. You got to go, okay. You got to throw in the Pearl Morset Cab Franc and
Right.
You know, and then someone will be a believer.
The one I think argument that I've come across, and you can't blame people for this, is, you know, we went from, you know, on Ontario or Canadian wines that were sort of okay way, way back when, to wines that are really good, but the price sort of shot up almost so quickly that when you put a wine on the list, $80, let's say, Cab from Ontario, great vintage, great producer, worth every penny. And then you have an $80, $75 Cab from California and or Chile or Argentina. People always take that default. And that's where I think the education piece comes in. And you have to take that risk with, you know, certain tables and say, listen, you want the same old Steady Eddie? Sure, no problem. We got that bottle. But you want to sort of have an experience? We have that bottle too.
Well, it's hard. You got to explain. Like, listen, the Thomas Batchelder single vineyard Pinot, it's the same yield as Burgundy. It's similar climate. Yeah. It's hand picked. It's all the same sort of things. And it's going to be cheaper than Burgundy anyway, because everything's cheaper than Burgundy.
Right. Yeah, good point. Man, it's crazy how those prices are just, you know, I love to drink them more often. It's just, you can't.
Really, oh, no. Really can't. Well, that you got it. Then it's just always seeking. What's the good village stuff? What's like, I feel bad. I recently poured for a friend, like a 13, 14 year old Premier Cru, you know, Burgundy. And now they're like, that's all I want to drink. I'm like, I am so sorry. Yeah. I hope your plans for home ownership have now been ruined. Right.
Or you have a rich uncle that has a deep cellar that you don't know about.
Oh God! Everyone, find that rich uncle.
Yeah,
find that rich. Hey, Corey, let's hear. I'm curious just a little bit about you said you were getting you got the bug for wine. Was there certain moments, certain bottles, those epiphany experiences?
You know, I think we've all had wine bottles that were, you know, heavenly or out of sort of body experiences, and you know, you can probably count them on both hands. But yeah, I was 19 years old working at Overtures and all I wanted to do was drink beer and party. But, you know, I worked with great people, and after service, we'd sit down and we would have wine. And, I just sort of followed the trend. And before you know it, you know, asking questions about the wine, learning about wine. And I got hooked. And, you know, being in Windsor, there really wasn't any sort of educational governing body to sort of expand my knowledge. So, you know, it took time to find that. But I drove back and forth for better part of 2 years from Windsor to Toronto weekly to take my ISG courses. You know, so I knew that I was hooked in more ways than one, you know, to be that committed. But I could say there's probably a few bottles. I think the first one, I tried to think about it, and I think the first one was a Hannah Zinfandel. And, you know, I can't tell you the last time I've even seen a bottle of Hannah, but that was sort of my first real, like, holy crap, this is different. You know, I didn't know what was different about it, but it was different. And then, you know, had the opportunity, some older, you know, Italians, like it was a 71 Barolo from Pio Cesare, an 85 Prodotto Fresco Rabaia, from 95, phenomenal, 95 Salon. Was, you know, as an epiphany wine for me. I didn't know champagne could taste and make you feel like that. You know, my desert island wine will always be champagne, preferably Salon, but if anything with bubbles would be my go-to for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's actually, it's funny. Yeah. My first one was an old bottle of Barolo, brick orange bottle of Barolo. And I'm like, what the hell is going on?
Right.
It looked gross. And then after I took a sip, I'm like, please leave the bottle. And could everyone leave the room? I need to understand what the hell is going on here.
Right. Yeah. It can be so special.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously you were committed to wine because ye Lord, the 401 from Windsor to Toronto is a horrible drive. What was your education? Was it the Independent Wine Guild? Like what was your,
International Sommelier Guild. And then so I got I finished that in 2004, and then enrolled in the quartermasters that same year. And a good, very close friend of mine and colleague Will Fredham, we took the ISG together, but he did it in Calgary, I did it in Windsor, in Toronto, and then we enrolled in the quartermasters at the same time. So
nice. Fredham, he was the one who told me about the magnum of Yellowtail.
Sure. Oh yeah, we've got some good stories.
at Canoe. Hey, tell people what that was like. Just the schooling, the exams, the blind tastings. I've told my story. Everyone who listens to this podcast have heard my dumb stories.
Yeah,
what are yours?
It's amazing to see what you put yourself through. But I think, to be honest, the difference between people that get so immersed in the culture of being a sommelier, taking their wine to the next wine education to the next level, I think it's really the support of the sort of community that you share these experiences with. Because one, it's a unique and sort of special thing that we do. You know, everyone thinks we sit around and drink wine all day. Well, yes and no. You know what I mean? There's a fun part about wine, and you can't take yourself too serious. But if you decide to take yourself more seriously, you really have to put in the time, the money, the effort, and surround yourself with people that are like-minded, right? So when I enrolled in the quartermasters, passed the intro and passed the certified, and then sat the advance and passed on my first go, which was great.
Woo, and by the way, just interrupt for a second. Passing the advance your first time. You know, again, congratulations. That ain't easy.
Thank you. And, it takes so much out of everything else that you do, and then when you have a family, and you have a career and you have all these other things that are part of normal life, you have to sort of either go in full force or you have to sort of take a step back. And, I've sat the MS exam a couple times unsuccessfully and taken a hiatus and promise myself one more kick at the can. So we'll see when that happens. But, it is very it's tiring, but not tiring like it's the worst thing in the world, right?
Hold on. Did you do your advanced with children in your life?
That was 2009. yes and no. My stepdaughter was in my life. My daughter, who is now 9, was not.
Okay, but still, you had a partner, you had, stepped out of it, still a child in your life,
sure.
And you were working and doing your advance. Okay, again, damn. Did you have the maps all over your walls?
Oh, they're still in my garage.
Are they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. I'll be in the garage with the door open, glass of wine, and or coffee in, double fisting. And I'm just staring at the walls, arms crossed in my garage, sometimes with my shorts on, t-shirt, hat backwards. And I'm sure my neighbors think that I'm just totally jacked or out to lunch because I don't think they realize what I'm actually looking at.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at a wall in my garage, right?
I love it. So you've got a glass of wine and you're figuring out the acidity of this Chilean Merlot as you're trying to figure out the rivers of Piemonte at the same time. Okay, so my version of that was before my diploma for WSET, I decided to find a cheap hotel near the airport.
Right.
And I stayed there for 5 nights before my exam. Just get because if I stayed home, I would clean. I would do other things.
Right.
So
maps
everywhere. And then in the bathroom, just lined up bottles of wine. And when the cleaning staff came in, there's like 14 bottles of wine open.
That's awesome.
And I'm trying to explain to them, I'm not an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I really need to nail Malbec. And like they had no idea what I was doing.
They red flagged that room pretty quick, eh?
Oh, yeah. And it's just like my mouth is purple, like I'm grimace and I'm.
You got spit cups everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. For people thinking of taking it, it's a lot of work. Like, my girlfriend had to watch me because the hard thing for me was I didn't work in the wine industry. So it's not like I was immersed in it. I would come home from my radio job and I would sit and the maps, the textbooks, the everything, study, and, spend a couple hours every day just reading and studying.
Yeah. Where'd you do your diploma, Matt? In the UK or?
No, I did in Toronto. There was the WSET, like around Young and Dundas there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I went to London for my graduation. And as I've said on many of these podcasts, I was too nervous to go and talk to Jancis Robinson.
Yeah, no, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I was like, no, I don't want to be that jerk. I'm just going to.
The legend.
Yeah, yeah. The one good thing, you go to a lot of parties and they say they're serving champagne, but it's Prosecco. You go to your WSET diploma, it's champagne.
Yeah, same for the court. Same for the court. It was always good. Always good bubbles.
Yeah. So What would you say are some of the main differences? One thing I'm curious about is, like, you've worked at high-end golf courses in Toronto and in Windsor, now at Essex, and you've worked at Spoke Club, so, you know, a little bit different, but, like, you know, sort of a high-end private members right. club, and then restaurants, Harry's Steak Joint right. in Etobicoke. Right. What are some of the main similarities and differences between those environments?
It's a really good question. I mean, you have to build a wine list, I find, at least around sort of a culture that you're trying to sort of promote. You know, the difference between, I think, a freestanding restaurant and private clubs is a freestanding restaurant focuses on a more narrow path. So, you know, if it's steakhouse, you're dealing with steak. If it's a Thai restaurant, you're dealing with Thai food. If you, you know, so you really can gear your list to that style, you know, build your budget on that. You know, this is what we sell in steakhouses. Yes, you can have a bottle of Sauvignon, but chances are you're selling 95% big bold restaurant. So in a private club, you know, you for the most part, you have more than one outlet. And in some clubs, six or seven outlets, right? So you might have a casual sports pub. You might have a place for the kids to hang out. You might have a patio. You might have something on the golf course. You might have banquets. You might have a formal dining room. You might have a casual dining room. These are all real things that happen in private clubs. So you're sort of gearing that to all of those scenarios. And you're also, you know, in private clubs, you have all repeat customers. There are no off the street clientele coming in driving, oh, let's go to Essex for dinner tonight. Well, unless you're a guest of a member, that just doesn't happen, right? So you're sort of, yes, you want to tailor your list to what the members want and or are comfortable spending, but you want to sort of, you know, expand it to fit into that mold of, let's make it a little bit more interesting without making it too wacky. So that's the real difference. You have a little bit more freedom in restaurants because people are coming to you for a certain reason, i.e. sushi, i.e. steak, whatever it might be. But in a club, they're coming to you for a lot of reasons. So you have to sort of be cognizant of that your seven years probably is not a good idea for a lot of reasons. One, cool, very cool. But you have to sort of base it on that. So, you know, even though clubs are great for those reasons, sometimes you wish you could expand the horizons a little bit, or a little bit quicker, I should say.
Yeah, no, I remember I'm a member of the National Club and in Toronto. And about 8-9 years ago, I discovered they had all these old German Rieslings.
Oh, and man, they got such a great list.
No, not well, not the Rieslings anymore. I drank them all. Because most of the members wouldn't. I remember I was sitting there one day and there was like a 14-year-old bottle of Rheingau Riesling for like nice. $47. I'm like, holy shit. And then you know, Brian Perry, you know, the psalm there. I'm like, Brian, sure. Over the next bunch of years, I'm depleting you of all this. They have a little bit left, but all that, their Pinot Gris or Gewürztraminers. I'm like, I'm going through this. If it's Eastern European, I'm gonna drink it.
And that's the beauty of some of these clubs, you know, Matt, and I'm sure you've seen it, like the York Club and the National, and they got these old bottles in there that haven't been marked up since they bought them, and you know, ports from the 70s and the 60s, and you know, DRC that you know before DRC was. You know what it is today, and it's just amazing. So those are the cool things about clubs is sometimes you can really walk in and be like, this is amazing.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. The most I once bought some old of their old Bordeaux, like Chateau Ausson. I probably mispronounced it, Ausone.
Yeah.
Right, just that right. And yeah. I got $320. It was mid-90s, early 90s bottle of it. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And I took that to the Drake in Prince Edward County. And the funny thing is when I arrived at that bottle was a celebrity, you know, because everyone there knew that they're like, oh God, look at this. It's so funny. Like that bottle was a celebrity that night.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah. Like yeah. If anyone's thinking of like, you know, I don't golf. I mean, like I don't join private clubs to, you know, climb the social ladder. Cause sure. I'm in sports radio. You know, I'm not here to make a deal with lawyers. I basically just joined for the wine.
Sure.
It's basically it. Do you have, was there a seller, was there a point with any of the sellers in all of your history, Corey, where you thought, okay, this seller is perfect? Because I imagine there's always, oh, we don't have enough of this or that. Was there ever a point where you looked at the cellar with pride, like a father watching their child, ride a bike for the first time, where your hands were on your hips, where you looked out in the cellar and you're like, yes, this is a cellar.
Yeah, Matt, I think I could probably say that. You know, I think there's always wines that you want to put on the list. There's always wines you think you need to put on the list. There's always wines that you should have put on the list, but I would honestly say by the time that I left Granite, that was probably the most complete wine list I've ever been responsible for. And not far behind, I would say St. George's was pretty much there. It was neat to sort of see how the culture of wine, especially at St. George's, changed and people just followed and understood that there was a method to the madness. You know what I mean? I think your controller always looks at you like for that first year, like, what the hell is going on? What do you, yeah, it was buy, 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 buy. And then all of a sudden it starts to reap rewards, right? So yeah, I would say both of those sellers, I was very proud to walk away from and be like, yep, good, sign off.
Yeah, no, I don't golf, but my stepdad is a member at Islington Golf Course. I have friends who are a member of St. George's and, as I said, off the top, I remember the last time I was at St. George's when you were there, I was looking at the list. I'm like, holy, this is, I was just really impressed with it. And, you put together a great list there. And then at Islington now versus, maybe when I was first there, I look at it now and, just very impressive. And it certainly cool. Like a lot of these places they've upped their game, which I think kind of speaks to how people have more wine knowledge now because of the internet, because of just there's more access for everyone to learn about all this stuff.
150%. I think that's a big part of it. And I think that, 15, 20, 25 years ago, there was maybe 5 restaurants, that you could go to and know that they had a strong wine program or, a solid, you can go every time, have a great bottle. It doesn't matter what it was, what your budget was. Now you can go to a lot of restaurants and have that similar same experience, right? So I think that's the cool thing to sort of see changing is people understand wine more. The younger generation is drinking wine more. It's not considered a posh experience to have a glass or a bottle of wine now. Everyone's accessible to everyone, right? And sometimes that's maybe bastardized the industry a little bit in terms of, are wines too mass marketed? Do they all taste and look and get treated the same? Maybe. But I think my philosophy has always been, at least with my teams, is, it doesn't really matter which wine they're drinking as long as they're drinking, right? Like, get it in front of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What's the philosophy now for you at Essex? I mean, you're in a different geographical area. Windsor is different than, every geographical area is different. What's the philosophy where you are?
I think it's definitely needs to be revamped/rebuilt. It's a very new world focus, and there's nothing wrong with that. But just sort of twisting things a little bit without trying to break the mold. And these things take time. And COVID isn't helping the situation with seeing what members really are drinking, because we don't have any members to be drinking it. But that being said, I want to sort of make it more approachable with representing areas that are underrepresented now, i.e. Italy, France, Germany, Portugal, Spain, all those sort of cool regions that you can still find great value without having to worry about, breaking the bank. So yeah, right now it's just sort of a little cleansing and rebuilding, and these things take time, but I know the support is there to work on the wine program and the culture of the club. So I'm happy to take that on for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, the work you did at St. George's, there's no way you can't do it at Essex, but to fit obviously the geography. How has COVID impacted you, Essex, and also, I mean, you're friends with so many people in the industry. Sure. Just your thoughts on what COVID has meant to the wine industry and to you and to the golf clubs over the last year or so.
Yeah, there's not a lot of great things that have come out of COVID, and I think we all know that, but I feel for all my friends and colleagues that are grinding it out and trying to make it work, whether it be takeout or limited seating or inside outside, building quasi makeshift patios, you know, trying to work within the confines that they've been giving. And, you know, some people are still making it happen. And, you know, hopefully there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And I really do think that it's coming eventually, you know, with more people getting vaccinated. It's a tough business to make money in the best of times. You know, the margins are so small, so minimal. So to have a restaurant that's open for 3 weeks, get 48 hours notice that you're going to be shut down again. I mean, a lot of people don't think about, yeah, okay, it sucks. We can't go back to the restaurant and have dinner. Well, what about all that inventory and the produce and the proteins and, you know, the staff that you're laying off for the fourth time in a year? Like, I think a lot of people sort of don't take those things into consideration. And I've talked to some chefs that have, you know, left the industry altogether and decided to get into something completely different that's more stable and more consistent with scheduling and income. And so, you know, you gotta go where the money is. And unfortunately, the money just is not there right now.
I never thought about that. That is one of the unintended consequences of all this is the talent drain. Like, yeah. Super talented, smart chefs,
sure,
deciding to ply their trade. And, you know, if you're a good chef, it means you have a good work ethic and, absolutely, you know, and all these different traits that maybe you could apply in a different, yeah, work environment. 100%. Now they might be leaving.
And they might have their evenings off now.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. It's so true. Oh God, you're right. They're like, wait a minute. I'm home at 7 p.m. Oh, this, yeah, is wonderful.
What's going on here?
I could see my wife or my husband and my kids. This is great. Sure. So as well, I'm just curious, Corey, what are you drinking now? Is there any region? Like, I find myself, I'm focusing a lot on New Zealand for both Hawke's Bay, Syrah and Bordeaux blends, and nice. not even as much Otago, but Martinborough Pinot Noir. Yeah. Those are what I'm sort of just focusing on trying to find. But I'm just curious, is there any area or anything you're drinking right now?
Tend to sort of stay to the lighter side of things. And that's been like that for a while, to be honest with you. More whites, dry, crisp, clean, unoaked, zippy, high acid, mineral driven, like crooners and stuff like that. I just find super satisfying. You know, I've always been a Riesling sort of fan and will continue to be for that same reason. You know, there's another,
by the way, hold on, got it, I gotta stop you for a second, because of course the obligatory Riesling, I said it earlier, everyone in the wine industry at some point, we all do the same thing, Corey, we all, sure, say Riesling.
It's because it's so giving and ask for nothing in return, man.
I know, it's so good.
So yeah, dry whites, probably the most frequent lighter reds, you know, Oregon Pinots. I've been a fan and still continue to be a fan. Great Cab Franc from Ontario. Another great, satisfying, savory bang for the buck, right?
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Shout out to Pierce Predom for their Oregon Pinot. Taws. Yeah. Taws Cab Franc does some good stuff. That's under $30. That's really good.
I don't know if you've ever had it, Matt. It's down this way, the Lake Erie North Shore. It's Michedre. It's a small, two brothers that run it, really sort of artisanal, small production, small lot cases, like, you know, 80 cases of this, 120 cases of that, but really cool, very good quality reds.
Really? What's the name, yeah, again?
Michedre. M-U-S-C-E-B-E-R-E.
All right. I'll remember enough of those letters to throw it in Google plus wine. And I'll absolutely, man, I'm always searching. I'm on all the consignment, yeah, lists. I get all the emails and I'm like, no, yeah, I'm not buying any wine. And then I'm like, oh, what's this Fallage Burgundy I should be buying a six pack of? It's just,
right,
it never changes. Well, Corey, I really appreciate you in the pod, but tell everyone, just give a plug to Essex about, you know, because people listen, like, you know, because here's the thing. Eventually, Ontario is going to let golf start up again, and it's going to be happening soon. And everyone's getting, yeah, vaccinated. So soon golf, yeah, is going to be open, and it's not going to be closed. So tell people why Essex, and also one or two bottles. I know your cellar is changing. It's evolving.
Right.
And where it's now versus going to be different than 6 months from now. But a bottle or two they should try if they come and visit.
Yeah, so let's start with the wine. So we've got the Mary Edwards Russian River, Sauv Blanc,
yep,
kicking around, which I absolutely love what they do. I mean, that's their jam. That's their what they do best, and it's so good. So that would be a great wine that I would love to have members explore a little bit more. Reds, going back to, I guess, one of my first epiphanies, it's a Limerick Lane Zin from Napa.
Oh, super yeah.
Cool. Again, breaking people away from that sort of cab mentality and getting them into something similar but different, right? What else is really cool? Chateau Fortier, the Chateau Neuf, it's got a few years on it. So things like that that I think are really interesting that can sort of, again, bring that segue around. Essex coming up on its 120th anniversary next year. Don Ross designed, it's super highly regarded, not just in the Windsor Essex County area, but in Ontario in general. Windsor is as flat as a pancake. You know, there's a lot of golf courses that pride themselves on undulations and mounds and ridges, but Essex is not like that. And it's a beautiful course, one visually, but a beautiful course to play. I grew up in the area, so Essex was always sort of the place that you wanted to sort of be at, work at, be with. So to be part of it here as a general manager is pretty cool, and I must say. And there's a lot of great things, a lot of history here, and we're gonna make it pretty awesome. I'm excited. It's awesome already, but to sort of take it to the next level is what makes me get up in the morning for sure.
Love it. Well, anyone listening, Corey did a fantastic job at St. George's in Etobicoke, and obviously did a fantastic job at the Essex Golf and Country Club. Corey, thank you so much for being part of the pod.
Thanks, Matt. Great to see you, man.
Yeah, great to see you as well. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.